Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey, it's Mozzie here. I don't have much experience when it comes to rallying, but Waukesha Racing Services does. And they're available now for your rally needs. They can help you with engines, design, paint, machining, fabrication. No job is too big or too small. There's CNC machines, 3D printers, a chassis build shop, and paint and engine shop that you can utilize. And you don't need to be an Aussie champion or factory back to be able to. From club to state to national level competitors and car owners, let Waukesha Racing Services help you with your rally needs. Call now on 1300 W Racing or email services at waukeshawracing.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Rally Sport Magazine's Special Stage Rally Podcast. My name's Luke Whitten and we're talking about rallying, the sport we all love. I'm with Peter Whitten. How are you, Peter?
G'day, Luke. I'm going well, thanks.
Very, very good to hear because we've got some state rally competition to start up this weekend, which is great news. We've also got a chat with Bernie Webb coming up later on in the podcast. He's a longtime tarmac and gravel rally competitor. He's got a business that's going really well in the pace notes space, and he's doing a lot of coaching as well. So it's going to be great to hear from him about how he's traveling in the sport. But across 1 week of rallying, there's so much news to cover, Peter. The first one that was big news, really, is that Racetalk in Western Australia are building Yaris AP4s. That's great news, and they're trying to build it at an affordable price so that then they can on-sell those cars and build them new for competitors who might not have the budget to be able to go to a Rally 2 car that really is the top class of car at the moment. What are your thoughts on that, Peter? And I guess it's always going to be good when you can build a competitive car that's also affordable.
It sure is, Luke, but yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. Racetalk have got such a long and experienced history in rallying and have won a lot of championships over the years, particularly with the MRF team in the Asia Pacific series over a number of years. It looks like it's probably going to be a budget AP4 car. And as you found out through your research last week, Luke, they're going to have an interesting specification and certainly different to what we're used to with the Yaris's at the moment.
That's right. The current Yaris car, or the Yaris AP4 cars that appear on the stages, they clearly have a Toyota engine and they've got a gearbox that's suitable for them. But these ones across in Western Australia will be based off the Peugeot 208 AP4 that's been running for them for a number of years. Now, that runs what they call the Joker engine. So the Joker engine is a common engine that you can use in any AP4 car. It's been developed and clearly it's a strong and reliable engine, but you can drop that engine into any body shell. For example, a Nissan might not have an engine that is suitable to run in an AP4 class, or if you did have a Nissan engine, you'd have to do all the development work yourself. Whereas in this new Yaris AP4 that Racetalk are building initially for Craig Rando, they're going to have that Joker engine that is well-developed and you can essentially drop it in and works fine. Transmission-wise, it's going to be a Subaru gearbox and also diffs as well. So they're well-known parts, particularly for Craig Rando, who's been running a Subaru Impreza WRX in the state championship over there, and he hopes to compete at the Forest Rally in the ARC round that's over there. He's 90% confident of doing that, but then he hopes to bring it across to the East Coast when costs allow. So it's all good news for Western Australia, and there's more and more Yaris's that are turning up, particularly in West Australia, as you learned.
Yeah, and just before we move on to that, Luke, and that Joker engine, it's quite well used. I mean, it was the engine that was in Eli Evans's Mini Cooper AP4 car and also the engine that ran in Emma Gilmore's Suzuki Swift over in New Zealand. So it's certainly got a good history and it should be competitive.
The other Yaris news, of course, is that the Dimex car, the ex-Harry Bates and Lewis Bates car, is going to Western Australia. Peter, tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's been purchased by Dylan King, who's a former Western Australian rally champion. And this is the first AP4 Yaris car that was built by the Bates team in Canberra. And as you mentioned, it was driven by Harry and also driven by Lewis before moving on to to Peter and James Dimmick, who've competed in it for the last couple of years. So Dylan King just missed out on the state championship last year in his Lancer Evo 9, and he hasn't driven the car yet, obviously. He's I think next week he's heading over to Canberra from WA to pick it up, and there was some talk initially that he may have been able to compete in Canberra for the ARC round in a couple of weeks' time, but that hasn't worked out. So he'll debut that car most likely in the Forest Rally in May.
What are your thoughts, Peter, on the AP4 versus G4, I guess, question? Because there's a couple of guys on the East Coast who've built relatively good G4 cars on a budget, and they've been able to put their Subaru or Mitsubishi four-wheel drive engine and running gear into a Ford Fiesta. These guys in Western Australia are doing it with an AP4 car based off the experience that they've got through Race Talk. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have a preference or maybe an opinion on what might be the best strategy to go to bridge that gap between a production car that is getting older and older versus a new Rally 2 car?
I think at the end of the day, Luke, it simply comes down to each competitor's finances. And look, if you've got the money, you can probably look into the AP4 situation, and they're probably a little bit more expensive to develop and put together, I would imagine. The G4 cars, and similar to the car that Nathan Quinn has driven for the last couple of years in ARC rounds, it can match the AP4 cars on speed at times, but I think to be able to do that regularly is a bit more of an ask. So the AP4 category, and certainly the way the Yaris have been built, they're certainly a much more competitive package, I would think, overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, because not everybody has the budget to go to a Rally 2 car. And when you build a G4 car and when you build an AP4 car, an outsider probably hopes that you compete in your national championship and do it really, really well in the top class of a state championship. But you've got to look back in terms of who drove Group N cars back in the day as well, because it wasn't just the people at the front that were driving great Group N cars. It was people also down the field in the state championships. So it's all part of that progression and that filtering down of cars that then end up in the hands of people who maybe aren't as skilled as your Harry Bates or your Nathan Quinn or your Eli Evans. So it's a progression that needs to happen.
It is, and that's a good point you make in terms of who the driver is, because clearly the capabilities and the speed of the driver will have a big impact, whether it's a G4 car, whether it's an AP4 car or an R5 Rally 2. And we've seen that in the ARC over the past couple of years with both Luke Kinnear and Tom Clark running top-of-the-line Ford Fiesta Rally 2 cars, or R5 cars as they were. And while they've been competitive at times, they haven't yet been able to maintain that speed and match it with the Bateses and even the Eddie Maguires. So clearly it's all good and well to have the best car, but you've got to be able to drive it consistently and at that speed. And that's not to say that somebody in a G4 car or an AP4 car who has outstanding ability can't match it.
And I guess you could say, Peter, too, that if you build a Yaris AP4 or you buy a Yaris AP4 from the Neil Bates Motorsport clan, then you've almost got a responsibility in some ways. Maybe responsibility is not the right word, but you've got this great car. Go and use it in the Australian Championship. When the Australian Championship comes to your state, at the very least, join up and see what you can do against the top class guys. You've got a really capable car. Rallying is all about testing yourself against the best. So when you've got a car that's capable, I think you should be jumping at the chance to try and compete in the ARC as many times as you can throughout the year.
Yeah, I tend to disagree a bit there, Luke. I mean, I think it comes down to the individuality of the competitor itself. And some guys, yeah, okay, they might have the money to go in and buy an AP4 car or a G4 car, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have aspirations of competing in the Australian Championship. And it's like anything. I mean, if you go out and become a footballer, you might want to play club level and have no aspirations of it going and playing at the AFL level. So I think everybody needs to be treated differently in that regard, because, as I mentioned, everybody has different aspirations on where they want to end up.
We can still bridge the gap, though, I think. If you have a state round, or sorry, an Australian Championship round in your state, it's not that hard for you to jump on board and be part of the national series, I don't think. Yes, there's a control tyre, but maybe it's just my point of view, but I think you'd want to test yourself on the same tyre and you're on the same road, so why not see how good you are?
There's a lot to take out of that, isn't there? I mean, the control tyre is one thing that's probably one of the major issues. And if you're a state competitor and you're doing the state championship solely for the year, and you're running on, for example, Dunlop tyres, if you have to then run on MRF tyres for the ARC round in your home state, then that might not really be an option as far as your sponsors go. So that's another point to look at. And I think while the state regulations do or don't allow AP4 cars to compete and score points, that will determine a lot of what happens with people with those cars.
We're getting closer and closer to what's one of my favourite World Rally Championship rounds of the season. Safari Rally Kenya is coming up on the Easter weekend, and it's going to be another great one. We've seen across social media, though, snorkels might be back, Peter. I know I'm formed part of the younger generations, and I don't want to sort of put you in the old category, but you grew up when there was snorkels on a World Rally car or a Group A car, when, you know, there was huge, huge river crossings in the Safari Rally. Maybe we might see that again this year, given the time of year change.
Yeah, well, obviously it's quite a bit earlier, the Safari this year, and we've all, I'm sure, seen those pictures of the Salikas going through the mud holes with water going up over the roof and the snorkel on top, and it'll be fantastic if we do get some of those conditions. I just feel that, that's wonderful and it'll be great to see, but the Safari Rally has been so sanitised in its latest iteration over the last few years. I mean, there's back in the day, and I understand that we can't always have conditions and rallies like they used to be, but they were open road and they were a lot longer distance, and it was a lot tougher competition between man and countryside, I guess. It was a really, really arduous event, the Safari Rally, whereas these days, and we've seen that the last couple of years, where it's just become pretty much an out-and-out sprint, pretty much like the Bathurst 1000 is now. It's 1,000 kilometres of qualifying laps almost. So the Safari's become a bit like that, but it will be great. And I do hope the weather conditions bring that into play and make it a real tactic that drivers need to look out for.
For sure. And when it first came in or first came back into the series, it was quite tame, like you say, but steps were taken and people in the WRC said to the organising committee, you need to make this harder because it's a Safari Rally. And as we sort of learned over the last couple of years, and as particularly the WRC working group that we spoke about on a couple of podcasts previously, they're trying to change up the championship and give some events an endurance status. Some events are going to be a little bit shorter, and particularly Safari is going to need to be one of those ones that really is a car breaker and is so, so hard to complete, let alone complete on the podium.
Yeah, and look, we look back at previous years and everybody always said, oh, Colin McRae wasn't a driver who could win the Safari because he wasn't easy enough on the car, but he won it multiple times because he just knew how to drive that rally and get a car to the finish when required. And it's a bit like we don't expect an Acropolis rally to be run on stages as smooth as in Finland or Estonia. And we expect the Safari rally to be tough and hard and the best guys win. And at the end of three or four days, if there's only five out of the seven or eight or nine World Rally cars or Rally One cars that finish, well, so be it. That just means that it's been a really, really tough event.
That's a whole lot of the appeal that what makes WRC so interesting and what makes rallying so interesting and so great to follow for us as an outsider and also for those who compete locally, which it's an adventure at the end of the day.
It is. And look, I'm sure that when the regulations allow for some endurance events and some sprint events, that obviously Safari will be one of those events that become quite a bit longer, I would hope, maybe some longer stages and not repeat stages like we've seen. I mean, I think everybody wants the Safari to be unique in that way. And it's one of the events that really makes the World Rally Championship different to other forms of motorsport.
This weekend, though, closer to home, the Mitter Mountain Rally and also the Manambar Rally in Queensland kicks off the state championships for the season. Clearly, Victorian and Queensland competitors will be heading to those events, possibly as they're listening to the podcast. So we hope you all have a good event. Peter, Mitter, you'll be there. What are your thoughts? I know Mitter's a few hours north of Melbourne, but, gee, it provides an interesting challenge.
It sure does, yeah. And look, the weather up here in northeast Victoria has been very hot the last week or two. It's cooled down a little bit for the next couple of days, but it's still going to be a warm event. I think about 28 degrees on the weekend and up in the Mitter Valley there. It might be a tad cooler, but certainly there probably won't be as much breeze to clear the dust. So it's going to be tough. 56 competitors for the event. Josh Redhead from New South Wales is the top seed, followed by Adrian Stratford, the former Victorian champion, who obviously had a big crash there last year. So it'll be a great event, also around the East Coast Classic Rally Series. So yeah, really looking forward to that, and it'll be great to get back out in the forest again.
And in Queensland, Peter, the Manambar Rally, you wrote the article this morning for rallysportmag.com. A quick reminder and a quick little plug to grab a subscription if you can. They've changed things up a little bit, and the event is a little bit different to what it's been in the past.
Yeah, it is, and they've got a good field of 30 cars. I mean, as we mentioned last week on the podcast, that Queensland had a shocking run over the last couple of years with obviously COVID initially and then wet weather cancelling lots of events for them. So it'll be great to see the Queenslanders get out there. And Ryan Williams is the top seed, the former ARC Junior Cup champion back in 2022, I think it might have been. Ryan will be driving his Subaru, the ex-Stuart Reed car. So he's probably favourite for the event, but Ian Menzies is always quick up there. Eric Johnson in another Subaru. And the Glenn Brinkman, who's in his first event after doing Dakar at the start of the year, and Glenn's back in his Evo 9 Lancer. So the Queenslanders will be out in force, I'm sure, and hopefully that's another successful event for them.
Absolutely. Without further ado, we'll move on to Bernie Webb, my interview with Bernie Webb, which was interesting, and I learned a lot actually out of it. So keep listening, and we'll speak to you next week, Peter. And may those who are competing this weekend have a great, great run.
For sure, Luke. And just a quick reminder that our Dust Trail series is coming up on the podcast, the Motorsport Podcast Network, shortly, and also with a new interview coming up next week. So look out for that.
Welcome to the podcast, Bernie Webb. We greet you on a Wednesday morning. How are you?
Fantastic, mate. It's a great day for rallying. Great day for me. Any day you're leaving home to go to an event is a good day. So yeah, really looking forward to spending a bit of time sitting down having a chat with you.
Great stuff. You're a co-driver of more than 20 years or so. When you go to an event or when you leave for an event like you are today, do you get nervous? Did you get nervous at the start? Has that changed over time?
It certainly has. Yeah, I started out rallying in 1997. So that's a few more years ago than I like to count. Mm-hmm. And look, things certainly have changed over time. For a long time, I would be up sleeplessly at night the night before, mm-hmm. sort of trying to work out what I'd forgotten. Yeah. Never really concerned about what was going to happen in the car. As people may think, it was more wanting to make sure I'd done the right job. So making sure I hadn't left anything at home, making sure I had a list in my head of what I was going to do when I was going to get there, when I got a road book and blind rallies, how I would prepare in that couple of hours. But yeah, certainly over time and as it's become, now for me for, nearly 15 years, a full-time role, it's just an everyday port of call, pack the bag, grab the things from where they live and hop in the car. Mm-hmm.
The Lake Mountain Sprint is the one that you're off to this weekend. But before we get to the here and now, you mentioned 1997 was your entry into the sport. We know that everybody gets into it differently. Either you're born into it through family connections or you've got a best mate who's involved in rallying. What was your step towards a sport that for some is very, very hard to get into?
The short answer to that is I met some guys at a party one night. The longer answer takes a few more minutes. So I basically went along to a mate of mine's sister's birthday party. We just finished school and met a whole bunch of guys of her friends who fast forward 5 years, fast forward 20 years have become most of my best friends. Sort of met them all in one go. They had great stories about club rallying and left the next morning, stayed the night, left the next morning thinking, wow, that was a fascinating evening, met all these cool guys, thought nothing more about it. And about 6 months later, a family friend rang me up saying, look, there's this rally on out in the forest. I want to go and have a look, but my mum says I can't go on my own. Driving out there on dirt roads on my own, I don't know anyone else who wants to come. Would you come along? And, oh, yeah, all right, whatever, come and have a look. Yeah. And after about 20 minutes at the spectator point, he was bored, wanted to go home, and I just kept saying to him, "No, you don't understand. I can't leave. I'm staying here. This is fascinating to me." And finally, after 20 minutes, half an hour of complaining, he was dragging me out, and lo and behold, these guys from the party walk into the spectator point just as we're leaving.
There you go.
So what turned into a hey, yeah, chat. I remember you. You're Dave's mate. By the way, have you got a spare seat? And the rest is history. We're still here.
Amazing, amazing. And you've been able to create a career out of it and co-driven, like you say, for 15 years with some of the best in the country. So it's a good passing moment. And like they say, it's those sliding doors moments that really make the most impact, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I spent the first couple of years, so I think it was 1995 that I all of that went on. I just finished school. It was the end of the year. And I spent the next couple of years. So the guys I met up with that night were servicing for a friend who tipped his escort over that night, which turned into a few months of helping rebuild that, which turned into servicing for him for a couple of years. And then, got an opportunity in 97 to sit in a car. And I actually clearly remember the moment two kilometres, probably into the first stage, where a light came on and I went, right, I know what I'm here to do. As you say, absolutely a sliding door moment, but for me, one that was very definitive.
Yeah, no doubt. And this weekend, you're with Laura Rogers in a Porsche Cayman GTS this weekend at the Lake Mountain Sprint. It's a tarmac event. It's a couple of hours from Melbourne. What does your preparation involve for that event? Clearly, with your business, you're there before the event, and when you're obviously turn up to the event, you're helping competitors, and you're also trying to do your best job you can as a co-driver too.
Yeah. Look, there are a fair few avenues to my involvement in the events. We went down and recce'd the event maybe a month ago, I think, and that's Steve Glennie and myself. So we went down, prepared the notes, and then have sent them out. I think we've got 30 or 35 teams running our notes this weekend down at the event. Today's Wednesday. I'm not sure when the podcast is coming out, but today's Wednesday. I'm heading down to the event with the last, I think, seven or eight books that have been last minute orders. Meeting up tonight with the team that I'm coaching tomorrow. We'll be out in the roads in a recce car at recce speed. Going through some training. They're a team that have been competing for two or three years, and this is, I think, my second session with them. And then tomorrow night, meet up with Laura and her husband, Gavin, who normally co-drives for her, and do something very similar on Friday, but then spend the weekend sitting in the car with her.
Yeah, that's great. Smoothline Notes is the business that we're talking about. You basically go out before the events, you create pace notes for people that they're then able to purchase and use for themselves, and obviously they get a good base, a good solid base for them to do their reconnaissance before the event. Where did it come from? You mentioned Steve Glennie, who's obviously a big part of that as well with you. Did you guys, as a driver for Steve's case initially, and now he's also a co-driver as well, did you think this is a great opportunity for us to be able to, help improve the sport and provide those safety notes to crews who can then improve their driving skills?
Yeah, look, it was some of the things that you've mentioned there.
Yeah.
Just, As with me getting involved in the sport, things just happen in a way over time that lead you in a direction.
Yeah.
So Steve and I spent 10 years in a car together competing, both on gravel and on tarmac. And, halfway through that process, I think we're in a position where we'd been loaned cars by a few people. We'd been writing our own notes. There was nothing available in the ARC at all. Steve had started out on bought notes on his tarmac career that he did before he came to gravel. And so he started writing notes. I was already writing with other teams that I was competing with, and we just carried on with what we were doing. But roll forward a few years, and we were being loaned cars by a few people who were also competing in their other car. And that turned into part of the trade was we'd provide them our notes. It became evident pretty quickly for a couple of them that the notes were too involved. So we were then developing a system to reduce the complexity of the notes and refine what was important, what wasn't for them. And that word sort of spread, and that went to two or three other people, and it started moving in a direction.
Yeah.
And for me, that sort of happened at a time when I'd met my now wife. I was starting to do some co-driving overseas. She was talking about a family, and we were looking at it saying, look, we don't really see how this can all fit together if I'm away all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was just a great opportunity to say, you know, here's something we can bring to the sport. We've developed our system in a different direction to what the other notes providers were doing.
Yeah.
We looked at it and said it's actually not working that well for the sport, because I think there were five providers at that stage. But sure. No one doing anything for gravel on tarmac. If you wanted to compete in every event in the year, I think we worked out you had to use a minimum of three different suppliers, right, crossing over both 1-6 and 1-10, and you had to write your own notes for a couple of events.
Yeah.
So we just said, look, that's not really a great system. It doesn't help people, you know, be involved in the sport, and thought we'd put ourselves out there and produce something that we can spread across the country, so that people are able to hop in and learn what notes are supposed to do before they start writing their own, if they choose to go down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're available for any event they choose to do in the country. Mm-hmm. Pretty well.
Yeah, that's really good, because they're such a complex part of the sport. And for a newcomer, it's a totally different language. Those of us who are in the sport and they know the sport, they can understand pace notes relatively easy, and they can have a go at making their own, but it's the quality of those notes and the consistency of those notes that are really important. And that's what you guys provide through what you're doing. It's really consistent, and it's really able to be replicated over different events, over different surfaces. And for people to buy those, it gives them the confidence and the knowledge that they've got good notes and they can drive to them and drive safely to them.
Look, that's exactly what we set out to do. Our markers are, if we can produce a set of notes that are accurate, consistent, and concise, then that's ticked all of our important boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So I've noticed so far, I've been interested to see how you reference them. You've used the terms pace notes and safety notes along the way.
Yeah,
we choose to use the term stage notes because we don't want to imply that suddenly we're going to make you fast. Suddenly we're going to make you 10 times safer. Our belief is that there is nothing at all that makes you safer in a rally than knowing what's around the corner. Roll cages and helmets and everything else are for there once you've made the mistake. Mm-hmm. But if we can give you the information to stay on the road, mm-hmm, because it's accurate and consistent, then that's what we're heading for. If you choose to use that information to go fast, great. If you choose to use it just to stay safe, that's great. Mm-hmm. But for us, what we're really about is about giving people that knowledge of what's coming. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the consistency, somebody who's just starting out and is trying to, sitting on the start line of a stage in recce for the first time with a blank notepad going, I'm going to write some stuff down. Yeah. Is very, very, it's a very difficult position to start from. It's it's much easier to know what you are going to try and document once you've actually seen it, used it, said, okay, cool, this is what I've got to do. Now I'm going to learn how to do it myself. And that's exactly the process we've taken with Troy Dowell. We started out using Smoothline. Troy was an incredibly good driver in rallycross before he came to rally. I didn't have to work with him at all on his driving, but it was about teaching him how to rally, teaching him how to apply his skills in the forest. And a big part of that was using Smoothline for the first couple of years, building up through our levels of complexity for him to get a good grasp of what he had to write. And then Troy's plans obviously are to go to Europe. So, we've then transitioned him off Smoothline, first of all with the easier events, and then with a couple of state rounds, and then into writing the Canberras and Queenslands and the other things on his own. So the last 18 months, Troy's been writing his own notes, and for him, he's the perfect model of what Smoothline's about. Being able to introduce people to being able to rally well.
That's right, yeah, and that's the approach that you've got to take. It's a slowly approach, I think, because if, like you say, if you do it from day one writing your own notes, it's very, very hard. But the transition is something that you guys are able to provide, which is great. You mentioned Troy Dow there. He was hoping to be a part of your 2024 plans, but unfortunately his health battles have returned, and obviously his leukemia he's fighting through at the moment. Are you able to give us an update on Troy and how he's tracking and how he's going in his recovery to hopefully getting back to the rally stages as soon as he can?
Yeah, sure. Look, this is one of the most devastating situations I've come across. You know, Troy is a remarkable talent. You know, for those who have met him and spoken to him in the service park, he's a you know, meek, quiet, you know, gentle guy who just turns into an animal when you hand him a steering wheel.
Yeah.
But he's not the guy who wants to, you know, go out and be fast today, who has to win everything now and take risks. He's the guy who wants to learn and be fast by doing well, but, you know, by learning to do it well. And look, that really shows in his you know, results. We've hardly put a mark on a car in the 4 years he's been running. He's had a number of ARC podiums just from, you know, trying to do what he does. So he's really primed now. He's got a great car. He's learned his craft, ready to go. And for him to have a relapse of his leukemia is just devastating. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to come at the start of the season, you know, heartbreaking time for him as well. But, look, you know, I've been in touch with Troy over the time. He's having a pretty rough journey. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm happy to say that he is as positive as anyone I think could ever be. So he had a couple of stints in the Alfred. He's been in intensive care there, you know, for a little bit of his time. He's on a trial drug at the moment, an immunotherapy, you know, trial drug, which is a 3-month course. Yep. And look, you know, it's a rough road ahead for Troy. But if there's anyone that can pull through this and be back on the stages, he's the man. He's got all the talent. You know, and I've been really fortunate to sit with some incredible drivers. Obviously, you know, Steve Glennie and Simon Evans would be the two standouts. Yeah. But if I had to put three fingers up for the best three drivers I've ever sat with, you know, Troy takes that third spot without a moment's hesitation. So I can't wait to be in the car when he overcomes this illness and gets back out in the stages.
Absolutely. I always look forward to chatting him at the service park and looking forward to doing so again, because he's, like you say, he's so understated. And when you chat to him, he says he's having a good day, but he's setting some pretty incredible stage times based on his experience and where he is in his journey. He's, yeah, a quiet guy, but gee, works so hard at his craft, and to be able to like get the speed out of the cars that he has, it's been incredible.
I've never met anyone who works as hard as he does.
Yeah.
Well, not many, shall we say.
Yeah.
You know, it's nothing for us to you know, a few years ago be on the way back from the final stage of a rally, talking about how things have gone and talking about how he was with his notes and you know, what was good, what needed work, and for me to bring up something saying, okay, look, I think you're missing this one thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, we then that's the last we speak of it, and get to another event, you know, a week later, 6 weeks later, and he will turn up in recce and get every single one right, because he's gone home, got the video out, studied it, looked at it, worked out what we're talking about, and gone, yep, I can use that. Mm-hmm. He's just you know, he's an amazing bloke, and he will do big things in this sport once he's overcome this illness.
No doubt. Our best wishes go to him, of course, and we hope he's doing well. You mentioned the top three drivers that you've sat with, Steve Glennie, obviously Troy Dow that we've spoken about, and Simon Evans. I tend to remember you speaking to me, or it might have been to someone else, that Simon Evans, when you sat with him in the co-driver's seat, everything suddenly unlocked in your brain as to why he was so fast. What was that reason, and how can you compare those three drivers?
Yeah, so look, that would have been part of a conversation about you know, my experience hopping in with Simon. Obviously, having competed against him for quite a number of years, I remember a great year in about 2007 or 8, maybe 2008, where Steve Glennie and I came out and did a few events in the ARC, but not very many. And we were sitting car three on the road at the last ARC round he and I did together up in Foster. And so first on the road was Simon, second on the road was Neil, and then we were third on the road. And so we had a clean road with two very distinct sets of marks on them. And we knew which ones were Neil's marks. They'd be the ones with the test brakes beforehand. Yeah. And Simon's were the ones that were exiting the road in random spots, reappearing somewhere else, coming, you know, cutting across a corner. And, meanwhile, Steve, who has the absolute opposite driving style, is, you know, just drives gravel like it's tarmac, ultra clean and neat, we're just watching Simon's lines going, I don't know how this can be. And, you know, we unfortunately went out with two in the second last stage. You know, we managed to bump a bank and break a ball joint, but we had a 8 or 12 second lead on Simon leading the rally at that stage. And I remember sort of sitting down afterwards looking at it saying, like, I know how fast we're going, but I can't imagine how you can possibly be fast and drive those lines. It just didn't make any sense to me.
Right.
So we'd been fierce competitors for quite a few years. We were teammates at Mazda. I don't think Simon was thrilled that Glennie and I had the good car. and he was in a little front wheel drive that he certainly drove the wheels off to show how good he was. Mm-hmm. But look, when the opportunity came up to sit with him, Ben Searcy, you know, one of my good mates who also I used to co-drive for, he had a clash. We were supposed to be sitting with Emma Gilmore in New Zealand and Simon in Tasmania on the same weekend, and that's a pretty tough call to make. But you know, Emma was a full year commitment. So, yeah, just call came up and went and jumped in with Simon, and we had an absolute ball, having been fierce competitors. But it just showed me where he generated his speed from, and it's such a different place to Steve. You know, Steve is all about slowing down before the corner, you know, relatively, and then being on setting one line through the corner, whereas Simon's all about arriving hot and adjusting the rotation of the car, you know, in the middle of the corner.
Yeah.
So look, he does a great job. I certainly, certainly with, you know, two impressive guys to sit with. But as we say, Troy's down the Steve path most definitely. But he's probably not. He's a bit closer to the middle.
Yeah, that makes some sense. And you sat with Mick Patton as well. You mentioned to me before we hit record on the podcast, he was quite green when you sat in with him. He initially won a prize with Repco, I believe, to drive in Rally Australia, I think, off the top of my head. And then he's gone on to do some great things in the ARC. Does he sit up there as a great driver that you've sat with? And in the current times, he's got a great car as well that he's developed through his skill and his business.
Indeed. Look, I had a fantastic time, sat with Mick for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years in the ARC, you know, first of all in one event in a car he built himself, and then very quickly realised that there were other things out there. So, you know, went through, you know, four-wheel drive to start with, and then into the two-wheel drive era, and then out the end of that into a fantastic leased Evo 10 that came from Race Talk, and he's since bought the sister car to that one, which has now been essentially reshelled into a Fiesta shell. So he's got a G4 Fiesta, which is a Race Talk Evo 10 Group N car underneath. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been quite the journey on that front. Look, Mick's a fantastic driver. He is, however, a guy who says that he never wants to go out and chase Harry Bates or Simon Evans or Steve Glennie or anyone else. Mick's aim in the sport is to be as fast as he can without ever putting a mark on a car. And so, you know, as we know, if you're going to go and push the boundaries, you know, occasionally there's going to be an egg broken while you're making omelets. So his take is to drive at a pace where that's not going to happen. And he's very, very open about that. But look, I worked with Mick. I think he was three events in when we started working together, and went from there to first outright at National Capital Rally was his highlight. And certainly, you know, for him, he's very much like Troy, just the guy who wants to learn to do better.
And a question without notice, almost, when you think about all those drivers that you've sat with, have you driven, first of all, and where would you sit on those lines? You've thought about the Steve Glennie, who's the clean and neat driver, who drives it almost like tarmac when he's on gravel, and then you've got a Simon Evans, who's the complete opposite. If you got behind the wheel, or when you've got behind the wheel, what's your kind of style?
Oh, look, yes, I have driven. I sold my car in 2006, had a Mazda RX-2, a pretty healthy thing that was built by Michael Barrett, one of the mechanics who works for Race Talk and certainly very well known, you know, in the rally world. You know, for me, I did a right in state events, but at that stage was both driving and co-driving. And at the end of the day, realised that I thought I had an opportunity to do very well as a co-driver at national level at least, and you know, driving was something I enjoyed, but it certainly took a back seat. And then once I started co-driving full time, you know, just didn't have the funds to pursue that. But look, I think probably the easiest way to flick it, flick the question, or you know, flip the answer, is to say that I am very fortunate that there are a number of guys that I have sat in a car with who I can absolutely wholeheartedly say, if I had their car for 5 years, I could never catch them. Not a chance. And certainly there's a few more than just those three. But it really is a special experience to be able to sit in and work with a guy doing something that you know you can see the skills that are there, and you know there's just no way you could possibly in a million years have the ability to do what they're doing, and know that there's no one else in the world who gets to experience seeing what they're doing. It's just the most amazing place.
Yeah, it's an experience like no other when you can see that and you can understand what they're doing. But yeah, as you say, you have no chance of doing it yourself with all the money that you could get in the world.
And to know that they're relying on you to the last little increment, and they can only do what they're doing because of the skills you've developed to be able to feed them the information they need. And it's such a special place.
Yeah. Tarmac versus gravel. You're one of the co-drivers that has competed for years and years and years on both. As a co-driver, does your role change at all? I know the note calling and stuff is obviously the same, but when you go to a tarmac rally versus when you go to a gravel rally, do you do anything differently?
Oh, look, yes, mm-hmm. yes and no. At the end of the day, you know, my core job inside the car is to feed notes to the driver at the moment when they need them to be able to build a visualization in their head of what's ahead to be able to drive to that. So, in many ways, the calling is actually different. Tarmac to gravel, the timing I find to be different because you've got the same grip level all the way across the road on tarmac. You're not relying on rotation and the car being set up quite so early. So sort of subtle differences in timing there, but gravel rallies and tarmac rallies in Australia tend to be run quite differently as well. So you know gravel's a very world that's very focused on penalties and compliance with process and whatever else, whereas tarmac rallies are much more about making sure that people are there and lined up and safe and ready to go, and it's all about what happens on the stages rather than the bureaucratic process in between. So from that perspective, a tarmac rally's much easier, but that said as well, it makes it more difficult when you've come from gravel land to sit there and go, I actually don't need to check in on this set minute or get a penalty. Yeah. And it means that when I go back to gravel, having done a lot of tarmac, suddenly I've got to go, okay, I need to be sharp on this. Whereas for, some other people, it might be just the same thing as they were doing last weekend.
Yeah.
But look, mate, it's the same sport all the way through and through there. In some ways attracts different people.
Yeah.
The tarmac side of things, there are a lot more people who show up for an event, to enjoy the roads, to drive within their own capabilities, to get through and have a good time and hang out with their mates at dinner afterwards.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit different to gravel land, but look, really it's the same people and the same sport, and everyone just out there having a good time doing something that the rest of the world doesn't quite understand.
Yeah, that's right. Do you see the two coming together? Obviously, the Targa Tasmania stuff and the fallout of everything that's happened over the past couple of years. Do you see them merging a little bit closer together in cars, in event types and whatnot, judging on what's happened and what may happen in the future?
Yeah, look, there's certainly a move to bring the two sports closer together.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not sure how that's going to play out. And in some ways, it'll play it quite well. In some ways, I think as I was saying before, the difference between the types of people that the two sports attract in Australia possibly not a perfect mesh. And it's difficult when you bring an event like Targa Tasmania where there's 500 cars showing up, and there are some parts to do with that don't quite work when you run it like an ARC or a WRC. But look, there are people working through that at the moment. For me, what I'm really hopeful of is that we can get the tarmac world, back out and running properly. There are still sections of it that are running quite healthily. But just want the big events to be able to function again, and whatever it takes to get that happening. I think it'd be, you know, there wouldn't be too many people arguing against anything that needs to be done if we can go back out and drive those amazing roads in Tasmania and have an event as iconic as that. There's a reason it draws so many people, and you know, can't wait to get back out there when everything's sorted out.
What does 2024 hold for you? We mentioned right at the start that you've got an event this weekend. But what else is there? What else is there in 2024?
2024 is a different year for Bernie Webb. Mm-hmm. We've obviously talked about Troy Dow. We were head down, committed in that land. And I think probably that's the side of my world that, you know, a lot of your listeners will be more familiar with. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm booked in for exactly zero gravel rallies this year. Mm-hmm. I haven't made a lot of noise about being available for the ARC. And I think that's probably a similar approach to the coaching work I do, where I don't make a lot of noise about the teams that I work with. You know, similarly, I don't want Troy's situation to be about me. But I'll certainly be out there. You know, any opportunities that come up, there's a couple of people I'm talking to quietly in the background. So yeah, certainly hoping to be out on the stages shortly. I'll be in Canberra. On the tarmac front, my main driver, Mark Cates, that I've been running with the last couple of years, has put the Porsche GT2 RS Club Sport, on the sideline for a year, just needing to focus on some business things. So I've got a reasonably full tarmac program, just coaching, coaching teams that I've been either done some out of the car work with, or have, you know, done one event with here and there. So including this weekend with Laura Rogers. This is the first time we've had much to do with each other. She's in a very good car, Pete Nunn built, who most of your listeners will know as being the guy who looks after Luke and Ears cars, and Les Walkton's before that. Mm-hmm. So Pete was running and driving this car himself. He's recently sold it to Laura, mm-hmm. and she's looking to learn how to step up and do things better in a quicker car.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've got a year of those sort of gigs booked up on tarmac.
And with the smooth line stuff and with the stuff as part of the Tarmac Rally Competitors Association, I think you're on ARCOM as well. There's lots of things to be able to fill in your time, and I'm sure that those events will book up pretty quickly.
Oh, look, there's certainly not a lot of spare time hanging around. With Smooth Line, we cover every tarmac rally in Australia and New Zealand. Plus the ARC, plus pace noted state rounds in New South Wales and a few other spots. So yeah, look, there's a bit going on. Plenty of coaching gigs, in between events. So free time still not that abundant, but I like nothing more than being out the stages in anger. So once we fill that. Those last few slots on the dance card, it'll be back to another fabulous year.
That sounds great. Bernie, have a great run this weekend in the Lake Mountain Sprint. Look forward to seeing you at the Rally of Canberra, and thanks for your time.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for the chat, Luke.
Hey, it's Mozzie here. I don't have much experience when it comes to rallying, but Waukesha Racing Services does, and they're available now for your rally needs. They can help you with engines, design, paint, machining, fabrication. No job is too big or too small. There's CNC machines, 3D printers, a chassis build shop, and paint and engine shop that you can utilize. And you don't need to be an Aussie champion or factory back to be able to. From club to state to national level competitors and car owners, let Waukesha Racing Services help you with your rally needs. Call now on 1300 W Racing or email services@waukeshawracing.com.au.